Welcome to Nature Now. Mary Robson here. We have fall weather, sun, and cool nights. That gets us in the mood to enjoy the color and crisp changes of the season. And this morning with the fog, I thought of Keats, Season of Mists and Mellow Fruitfulness. Today, we'll air the second part of Bats of the Olympic Peninsula, recorded by Debron Kelso with Tom Butts. First, the mystery sound, a clue. This is a mammal. You won't think so when you hear the sound. Now some observations. Alex Henley will help me with these today.
Rare cloudless nights let us see the full glory of stars, and the last 2 weeks of the middle of the night has been fascinating. Another meteor shower adds to the fun of watching. Present now is the Orionid meteor shower from September 23rd to November 27th, but most visible Sunday, October 22nd, and on to November 7th. It's caused by debris scattered from Halley's Comet. Halley's Comet was last seen in 1986. Bits of it show up in Earth's atmosphere when Earth intersects the comet's orbit, as it does this time of year. The comet is nowhere near Earth now, but we can observe its falling rubbish, rock transformed into meteoroids as they fall. At this time, the Earth passes through the most dense area of the material from the comet. Joe Rio, writing for space.com, explains the phenomenon this way. Meteoroids are the remnants of a comet's nucleus. When approaching the sun, the frozen material present on the surface of a comet's nucleus sublimates, going directly from a frozen to a gas state. In the process, the comet leaves a trail of dust and debris strung out along its orbit. These bits and pieces are so small and brittle, with a consistency of cigar ash, that you could easily crush them with one hand. Crush a comet with one hand seems like a task for Wonder Woman. Orion is obviously named after Orion, the constellation of three bright stars lined up in the eastern sky. Meteoroids tend to fall slightly north and east of the constellation.
Thank you, Alex. I did observe one meteoroid, possibly. I was staring up from my deck Sunday night, and I saw one meteor at 4:15 a.m. Then I went inside Orionid meteor showers, and the amazement of stars reward the effort of waking early to share dark sky times. And now we get to meet Eleonora, the giant Pacific octopus. She's been living at the Marine Science Center for about 4 weeks, and she appears comfortable in a tank decorated to her needs. Jonathan Crossman, one of her helpers, said they rearranged the tank's stones to create a den for her before her arrival. Because she came from a Friday Harbor Research Center, she had previously lived in a tank, but moving means lots of change. She's about 2 years old. When I saw her, she was quiet. Perhaps she was napping. Although human terms don't fit an octopus, her eight arms were folded and rolled under her body, giving the odd effect of a pale pinkish-brown bird on a nest. Her arm spread from one arm to the end of the other is about 3 feet, but she can move her boneless self into remarkably small spaces. Crossman said she had eaten a crab about 4 inches across 4 days earlier, using her tentacles and tiny suckers to extract every bit. And they do have a crab shell you can hold that shows you that she did not leave a thing. He added, for her, that's the equivalent of eating Thanksgiving and Christmas dinners together. Having this local giant Pacific octopus here to observe and appreciate is a delight and a privilege. Perhaps when you go, she will be on one of her tank explorations, moving around as she learns. You may see her unfastening large Lego blocks or Mr. Potato Head as she demonstrates her intelligence. The leader paper for October 17th also introduces her and discusses the process that got her to Port Townsend. The Marine Science Center is open Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from noon 5 p.m.
As of October 19th, Nick Bond, a University of Washington atmospheric scientist, said that sea surface temperatures across thousands of miles of the North Pacific and Gulf of Alaska are now up to 3 degrees Celsius warmer than normal, which is quite a bit. A ridge of high pressure is keeping skies warm and dry, allowing heat to build up. Predicting ocean changes requires considerable maybes and coulds, but what is clear is that northern Alaska and the Arctic has been warm this fall. Cliff Mass, a meteorologist at the University of Washington, called it another blob, such as the one experienced in 2013 to 2016. That affected marine animals and shore life significantly, as it contributed to seawater warmth and drought. The actual effect of the current sea surface temperature change will be experienced somewhat gradually, and most commentators aren't leaping to announce another blob. Last week, the National Weather Service predicted a warmer than normal winter, with Alaska and the Pacific Northwest listed as being within the warmer area. As to the blob, Cliff Mass wrote last week, "It looks like things are evolving to a pattern with less high pressure offshore, so the blob should weaken." Which may or may not happen.
This is an observation about birds on the move. I had a varied thrush splashing in the bird bath this week. A normally shy bird, which is generally gone during the summer. Is it here to stay? Perhaps it needed water during these dry late October weeks. A group walking with Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society at Gardner Beach and Diamond Point reported seeing marbled murrelets. It seems remarkable considering the threatened condition of these birds. They also reported a merlin and a harlequin duck, the duck that carries all the colors of autumn on its plumage.
And now on to our pre-recorded talk with wildlife biologist Tom Butts, who spoke with us about bats of the Olympic Peninsula a couple of weeks ago. If you want to hear the first part of this conversation, please go to kptc.org and search for Nature Now podcasts. Last time we ended up with your review of the bats that we have here on the Olympic Peninsula, Tom, did you say that we have 11 different species here?
Yes, we do. Some of them are quite common, like we'd find around Port Townsend, maybe at Cotai Lagoon, like little brown bats. Yuma bats are quite common. Bats that are quite rare are bats like Keen's myotis, which have only been found a few times over on the west side of the Olympic National Park. And they range in size from very small, maybe 5 inches in wingspan and weighing less than a nickel, like the California myotis, to as large as a hoary bat who might have a wingspread of almost a foot and weigh 6 times more than a Yuma bat or a California.
Around my place, I only seem to get the small little brown bats. Where do the hoary bats hang out then?
Hoary bats and silver-haired bats, two of our relatively common. They're not abundant, but they're not what I'd call really uncommon. And they both live in trees. They hang out in trees. They're in the open in the daytime. It'd be very hard to see them, but they're up in dense covered trees like western red cedar.
We should probably mention that we usually think of bats living in large groups in caves, but our bats here don't really do that, do they?
We don't have that many caves, but most of our bats live either in trees, in cavities like woodpeckers make and like owls use, smaller owls in particular. Many bats live underneath the crevices and cracks in old Douglas fir or western red cedar. Other bats live under shingles in attics and things like that. So all kinds of different habitats, depending on the species.
One time I was out in the field around dusk and saw a bat come out from between rocks, just a crack in a rock, and this thing emerged. And I was like, it's a bat. And it was wedged between these cracks in the rocks that I didn't think anything could fit in. But that means that our bats don't congregate in large groups then. Do they roost singly or in small groups?
One of the fascinating things about bats to me is there's just such a diversity in where they roost and how they roost, depending on the species, depending on even the sex of the animal, depending on the time of year. As a few examples, most of the males of all of our species of bats roost singly in the summer and often in the winter. but they may also congregate in large numbers in what we call hibernaculum, which is where they hibernate. And in there you can find anywhere from dozens to thousands of bats in the western United States. Those might be in caves or abandoned mines. Or they might be in buildings. Big brown bats might congregate in groups of just 10 or a dozen or so in an attic or somewhere like that. In the summer, there are fairly large congregations of females having babies. They get together in something called a maternity roost where they have their babies. And if they're not having babies, then they're very likely not in larger groups. They're in individuals or small groups. And once again, the males are usually roosting by themselves. And often in higher elevations as well, like a lot of our bats around here are probably females in the summer, and males go higher up in the mountains.
That's interesting. And there's also niche separation depending on whether the females are lactating or not, right?
Exactly, having their babies. Like, that's the ones that are in the what we call maternity roosts.
They're in larger groups, but are they also in different habitat types than single females?
Well, one thing that they're doing is they want to find somewhere they can keep their body heat up. And the reason they do that is because they want to keep their milk production up. They want to keep their babies' temperature up because they grow fast. And if they drop their temperature very low, there wouldn't be enough growth. If they're not having a baby, if it's a female without a baby, or if it's a male, they can find areas where their body temperature can drop down to ambient temperature. Even if it's in the 40s or so, it's fine. They conserve energy that way.
So what about hibernation in our bat species? Do our bats leave the area or do they hibernate?
Both. Some of them, like the silver-haired bat and the hoary bat, actually migrate far to the south, probably into Mexico even further. Others that we have may stay very local. Big brown bats very likely could be hibernating right in our area. A lot of the myotis migrate to caves or mines, and they may go a few hundred miles wherever they can find the appropriate habitat, and then they'll come back here in the spring.
Would you go into a brief description of bat biology in our area here? How long do they live? How old are they when they first reproduce? I suppose it varies a lot depending on what species we're talking about.
I can make some generalities. Your average mouse, it'll be lucky to live a year. A lot of them live in the summer. They're very active, and they're also high predation, and they maybe live only a few months. An old mouse, a year old, would be a lot. The same size bat might live 10 years, maybe even 20 years.
Wow.
Which is phenomenal. And even the small ones, like we mentioned, the Yuma myotis or what, might live a decade or two. The reason they can do that is because of this, both hibernating and because they can intentionally lower their body temperature. Like you mentioned, the hummingbirds last interview and how they can lower their body temperature.
Go into torpor.
It's torpor.
But it's daily torpor. And it's not a true hibernation.
Right. And bats can do daily torpor as well. They lower their body temperature to ambient temperature unless it gets below freezing, and then they kick on the heater, but just enough to stay alive. So they use far less energy that way.
And they live longer. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. It's like they're in the fridge for a good part of the year. So we know how a fridge preserves our food, and it's kind of the same idea with the bats, right?
Exactly. And they do it daily. Like the bats that we see in the summer are going to a night roost, which often is quite concealed. It might be cool, might not be, but their temperature will stay whatever it is outside. And then they go out feeding at dusk, and then they go back to a night roost. And they'll also lower their temperature to whatever is ambient temperature. And then they kick on the heater early in the morning hours, go out and feed again, have a drink, and then go to their day roost for the day. Where they lower their temperature? They don't lower their temperature. They allow it to reach whatever. So if it's high, it goes high. If it's low, it goes low. So they're not
depending on what the ambient temperature is.
Right, exactly. Mm.
But something you were telling me that's really interesting is that lactating females are way more vulnerable to weather changes because they can't go into that torpor state, right? They have to keep those young warm, so they can't get too cold.
That's right. They keep their body temperature up actually over 100 degrees Fahrenheit while they have the baby. So they are using a lot more energy during that period of time, a few months, while they're having and raising their babies.
And then they need to eat way more too, because they don't have any kind of mutual caring of the young where males will bring food to the females while she's lactating.
That's correct. They have to do it on their own.
And bats, regardless of whether they're male or female, are especially vulnerable during that hibernation period, right?
They are, because they're congregated and because they're not too conscious. So whenever there's a disturbance, like if a human being goes either intentionally or accidentally into a cave where there's hibernating bats, they can disturb those bats and wake them up. And when they're awake, they can use in a few hours their entire supply of energy for the winter, which means they're not going to survive the winter, even though it might look to the people that leave the cave, oh, they're fine, they're still alive, but they've used their energy budget.
And then they starve because there aren't any insects for them to feed on. It's amazing how we don't realize these things sometimes. So how are bats faring worldwide, and how about in our area?
Bats in a lot of the world are not doing very well, bat populations, for many reasons. One of them is that for a long time, people have been afraid of bats, so they just kill them when they find them in concentrations, or even when they find them singly. There's also been a lot of habitat loss. So as I mentioned, a lot of our bats are dependent on trees, and when we eliminate trees, we eliminate bats. Also, people inadvertently going into caves, as there's been more and more activity and interest of people going into caves, even with best intentions, they can do damage to bat population. And then, believe it or not, in some parts of our world, people eat bats. So in Asia and in some of the Pacific Islands, they're considered tasty delicacy.
What is white nose syndrome, and is it a threat to bats in our area?
It's a disease that has shown up a number of years ago now, within the last 10 years, I think. It's a fungus that was brought here from Europe, and in Europe, the bats seem to have adapted to living with white nose syndrome. But it was brought here inadvertently, possibly by humans, introduced into large populations of bats in the East, winter hibernacula, and in some cases is killing 100% of the bats in these very, very large concentrations.
And that's part of the problem, right, is that the fungus spreads really readily amongst densely clustered bats.
Exactly. So it's generally in the winter that it gets spread. It's spread through contact as well. So the disease has progressed westward. For the most part, the furthest west it's been documented is in Nebraska. Unfortunately, one was found last year in Washington State, but only one. And I think it's kicked up the effort to document if there's any more in this state. But so far, no more has been found.
And they think that the fungal spores from that came from the eastern U.S.,
That bat probably came from the U.S. is my guess. I suspect it crawled in into a load of lumber somewhere or something and was hauled out accidentally on a truck or something and woke up and said, oh, where am I now? Oh, I'm in Washington.
Yeah, but that's something to be aware of, is that humans that are exploring caves can readily spread that fungus, like carry the spores out on their shoes and spread it to other places without realizing, right?
That's correct. That's why if you are a caver, a spelunker, you really need to follow a certain protocol. And bat biologists do the same thing. We make a very big effort not to wear clothing that we've worn in one location and wear that in another, or boots, anything like that. Mm-hmm. You need to sterilize all of that before you go into a new location.
And what about the threat of rabies?
Well, that's a human threat. It doesn't seem to bother bats very much, but it's a big concern. Needs to be a big concern, but not a fearful concern for human beings. It's just mostly something that you should be aware of. Bats do carry rabies. They, in a wild, free-flying population, perhaps 1% or so may have rabies. The problem is that bats that are found by humans or by pets, usually during the day, are behaving strangely. Therefore, they're likely sick.
Yeah.
And those might be up to 10% of those have rabies, and you do not want to contact rabies.
Are there any tricks to safely remove bats that have inadvertently come into our living spaces? I mean, obviously, wear gloves to try to catch them and put them outdoors. Are there any other tricks that you can think of?
Well, that's the main thing. A lot of people try to kill them. You don't need to do that at all. If you had a fairly fine meshed net, I've caught them in a baseball cap before or something, but you have to be quick and they have to land usually, and then you can take them out. But I definitely recommend having gloves. If you do handle one, or especially if you get bit by one, do get it tested. You should try to get the bat. If you can't get it, you really should seek a health professional.
Well, and something that I didn't realize until recently is that you don't have to be bitten. It can be transmitted through saliva. It's really important to wear gloves when you're handling bats. So what can we do to help bats in our area?
For one thing, if you're a caver or whatever, do be aware of taking precautions not to spread that. One of the big things these days is having a bat house. We should talk about bat houses for just a moment because they are useful.
Yeah, and you put together a cool book about bat houses.
Yes, I did. So I had to learn a little more about them, believe it or not. So one of the problems with most bat houses that people buy at the nursery or get for a Christmas present is that they're not large enough. They should be a few feet high, have several chambers. I don't want to go into much detail, but you can find out things on the internet or through my brochure or other places. But the main thing is they are mimicking a tree. And so the best thing is to preserve trees, especially older trees, dead trees, trees with big shaggy bark. That would do more for bats in our area than just about anything.
When is the best time and place and season to see bats in our area?
Well, definitely in the summer. They're pretty hard to find in the winter.
Whenever we've got a bunch of insects is probably the best time.
That's exactly right. And where there are a bunch. So near water, right at dusk, maybe half an hour after sunset, there's enough light to see. Some of our species don't come out till it's pitch dark, but there's a number that are out flying early enough to see.
So do you have any bat lectures coming up if people want to learn more or if they want to go on a bat walk? I mean, obviously for that, we'll have to wait until next August.
Right. I don't have any plan, but I certainly want to do some more in the area next summer.
Oh, great. If you can't wait to learn more about bats, there are also several great websites that you can log on to. There's batsnorthwest.org. There's a group out of Olympia called batsabouttown.com. And the Washington Department of Wildlife and Fisheries also has a lot of great information. You can go to wdfw.wa.gov and search for bats. So thanks so much for joining us, Tom, and we'll hope to join you on next summer's field trip.
Great. Hope to see you there.
The mystery sound. Of course, it's bats. After listening to wildlife biologist Tom Butts talk about bats here and their winter hibernation or ability to allow their body temperatures to drop to ambient air temperature, here are a few more tidbits about bat behavior. Many of you listening may have been surprised to hear that female bats give birth and nurse their young. Bats make up one-fifth of all mammal species worldwide. That does not mean that one-fifth of everything is bats. It means that of the species noted, one-fifth of them are bat species. Bats here eat insects rather than fruit, as tropical bats do. One bat may gather hundreds of gnats and other insects in a single night. I've seen the little brown bat up close, tucked into a large patio umbrella. When I opened the umbrella, the bat tumbled out, shook itself, and flew off. Their wing structure differs from bird wings in that they are able to manipulate the wing into many different positions, akin to a human arm. One classification of bats is Chiroptera, Greek for hand wing. Events? Maybe everybody's getting ready for Halloween. Here's the one I could find. October 24th, a Wednesday walk at the Dungeness River site. 8:30 to 10:30, meet at the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society. These Wednesday walks are continuing every Wednesday between now and May 19th, 2019. Who would believe it? And for another event on Halloween, listen for Nature Now on Wednesday, because we will be telling scary stories. All three of us will be here telling the scariest things we can possibly figure out about animals and myths about animals. And why are people scared of spiders? That's my favorite. Listen up for that happening on Fundraising Day. That's it for Nature Now this week. We hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations, or ideas. Email us at naturenow@kptz.org. Nature Now airs at 12:05 p.m. on Wednesdays with repeats here on KPTZ at 91.9 FM on Thursdays at 5:05 and Saturdays at 12:30 p.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the KPTZ website. Thanks for listening.
I'm Alex Henley.
I'm Mary Robson. Have a great week.
The closing song is Dispatch with Bats in the Belfry.
Old Man River said you can go your own way if you just leave him alone. It doesn't matter, do not deliver all your things today. We are going home. Oh mama, we're now so hungry. Oh mama, we're now so hungry. Oh mama, we're now so hungry now. We're now so open, catching all the leaves. We all see what we want. Yeah. Old Man River said you can go your own way if you just leave him alone. It doesn't matter, do not deliver all your things today. We are going home. Ooh, mama, we're now so hungry. We're now so hungry.